So I am very sorry that we're already going to be speaking about Pesach, but I don't know if you knew this. After Purim, Pesach tends... Thank you. After Purim, Pesach has this way of sneaking up on you.
There is no woman who doesn't know that.
Really?
No woman. Even
I want you to know it's not only women that feel it. Men feel this as well. Because 30 days before Pesach, you have to start learning the halachas of Pesach. So I sat and I started preparing for Pesach as well on Purim. We all have different ways of preparing. This is better because my normal preparing is I go away, which is addition by subtraction. Okay, so today what we're going to speak about. Thank you. Today's shiur is Le'ilui Nishmato Shel Chaim Tzvi Dan. Chaim Tzvi Ben Reuven Frida Miriam, who is?
It was my husband.
Okay. So this should be for his Eloi Nishmato. So what we're going to talk about today is specifically about selling chametz, and generally we're going to speak about legal fictions. Mm-hmm. Because I think that halacha tends at times to make people cynical, because if, you know, we have a problem with Shemitah, so we sell the land. We have a problem with Pesach, we sell the chametz. The joke is that if the rabbis ever would do what they should do and say that smoking is not allowed, then Jews would sell their lungs to non-Jews. And it tends to create cynicism. And I think that each one of these things need to be considered on their own and their own merits, and to understand the dynamics of how they work or perhaps how they may not work. For example, when one speaks about the idea of the Heter Mechira, and I mean, before I say anything about it, I'm only saying this because we're after Shemitah and so on, and I may have said before, may have not, I don't know. I personally think that the Heter Mechira is a legitimate Heter which should be avoided. How clear was that? Okay, I think that one shouldn't have the attitude that it's not good. One shouldn't have the attitude that this is a joke, or one shouldn't have the attitude that that anything, you know, anybody who relies on this is somewhat less of a Jew. There were some very, very big rabbis who said what I just now said, including Rav Moshe Feinstein of Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, including Rav Scheinberg, and you can keep on going down the list, who personally said that, you know, if we're already in Israel, one of the things about being in Israel is keeping the mitzvot otuliot ha'aretz, keeping the particular laws, so we should really endeavor to try to keep them. On the other hand, in modern Israel, where you have you have a majority of people who are not religious, so therefore the expectation that people will keep the law as they're supposed to is virtually a fantasy, and therefore for people who won't be keeping Shemitah properly, it's a very good thing to have the Heter Mechira. And if one is in a situation where one is stuck, so then, or I'll give you an example of stuck. You're invited to someone's house who keeps the Heter Mechira, then you're allowed to eat there. That's what I'm talking about, stuck. Because it is a bona fide Heter. Now there is, of course, revisionism in this, like in many other things. So I don't know if I've mentioned this in this particular form, but Rav Shlomo Zalman Aruch has a very, very thick book about Shemitah, and a majority of the book is about the Heter Mechira and how it can be used in all kinds of situations. So when his children or grandchildren or students republished the book for this Shemitah, they took out all those sections, and they have a very, very small book right now. Mm-hmm. And they renamed it or something, which was almost the same, but this is certainly revisionism. The other thing about the Heter Mechira, that it was not made up by Rav Kook. It was made up long before Rav Kook ever got to Israel. But years ago, during one of the Shemitot, there was a situation that Israel wanted to, this is a political term now, not a halachic term, wanted to give land back to other entities. And being that it was Shemitah, the land was sold before Shemitah. So it went to the Supreme Court. They said, they can't give the land, it's not theirs. And the Supreme Court threw it out and said, no, that's not real. Now, when the Supreme Court of the country is saying that, when the Supreme Court of the country is saying this is not a real sale, that does create a problem. That's not a simple point. That means that they are not respecting that sale. So again, I'm not speaking any more about it right now. I'm just saying is that's one of the reasons, one of the considerations, to say, you know what, maybe one should be a little bit more careful about this. But my point is different anyway, and that is that I think that if one lives in the land of Israel, one should do all they could to keep the proper mitzvot. But what it does do is it creates cynicism. And probably Mechirat Chametz creates a great deal of cynicism as well, because we just go through some kind of motions before Pesach and we sell the Chametz and now everything is fine. And then lo and behold, right after Pesach, we get it back and miraculously everything's fine again. So did something happen in the meantime? And again, is this a legal fiction? Now, to understand if it is indeed a legal fiction or if it's something which works in terms of halacha, what we first need to know is what is it that we need to get rid of in order to understand if we have efficiently gotten rid of it? Was that English?
Mm-hmm. No.
Was it close to English? I'll try again. We need to understand what the prohibition is of owning chametz in order to understand if selling chametz effectively gets rid of chametz. Was that better? Second thing, which I want to, and perhaps we'll start with this, is who made up this idea of selling chametz? Where did this come from? Is this something which some rabbi in the last 50 years, or maybe even some Zionist rabbi in the last 50 years came up with, or is this something which is perhaps a little bit older? So we have a source which is an ancient rabbinic source, which is a Tosefta. Tosefta is the same time frame as the Mishnah, and that's in source number one, Tosefta, which should not come as a great surprise in Masechet Psachim, which gives the following case, which makes it sound very much that a case like this actually happened, and because of the case that happened, the rabbis gave a ruling. Yisrael v'goy shehoyu ba'in b'sfina. Now, it could be on these days that when you take your cruises, you know exactly when it's leaving, exactly when it's coming. Travel by sea in those days was not necessarily predictable. And you got on your boat, and hopefully you got. Hopefully you made it to your. I think I read once that I don't remember right now if it was 25% of people got where they're going or 25% didn't get. I don't remember which way it was, but excuse me. Yeah.
They didn't know where they were.
Yeah. So 25% either way, you're not dealing with great percentages, and that's why they benched Gomo, because every time you got on a boat, you were literally in a life and death situation. I mean, the boats also were not. That shall we say, and it was not just not sturdy, but they didn't give a great deal of confidence. And people ask me today when I fly, I never say Birchat HaGomel. I mean, let's be honest, the drive to the airport's more dangerous than the LL flight itself. But the idea of a Birchat HaGomel is that when you were in a life and death situation, you were saved by a life and death situation, so you say Birchat HaGomel, which basically is in the place of bringing a korban todah, thanking God for saving your life. So when you traveled the sea and you made it, then your life was saved. Over here, aside from the difficulties involved, there was also a question of timing. So therefore, there must have been a case that somebody was traveling, assumed he would get to his destination before Pesach, and lo and behold, he's stuck at sea. Yisroel v'goy shel yubon b'sfina, they're traveling on a boat, v'chametz b'yad Yisrael, and the Jew happens to own chametz. Hareza mochro l'nochri, he sells it to the non-Jew, u notno b'matana, or he can give it to him as a present, v'chozer v'lokeich min achar Pesach, and he could then get it back after Pesach, uvilvad shinol b'matana gemura, on condition that it's given or sold completely, no strings attached. Now, that may sound to you like it's a contradiction from the first part to the second part, right? Now, that's a very important thing over here, why this would work or why that is not a contradiction. There is a thing which is called matana amanat lahachzir. I give you a present on condition that you're going to give it back to me. Matana al minat lachzir. A present on condition that you give it back. What is that called? Well, it's not called a present. Right. It's not called a present. Right. Right? But you say it right away. It's not afterwards you ask for it back. When you give it, you say, I'm giving this to you unconditionally. Give it back to me. What's that called? That's called a loan. That's not called a present. That's called a loan. So if you loan somebody your chametz, then it's your chametz. Right? So here's a very simple point. We are not permitted to own chametz on Pesach. So the question is going to be, how do we get rid of owning our chametz, or how do we separate our chametz from ourselves? So over here we have a Tosefta, which tells us that we had somebody who was in a difficult situation. The situation was he was traveling the long way. Now you can say to me, hold it, why didn't he just throw it overboard, why didn't he eat and so on? You know, there's all kinds of practical things. On the other hand, historically, I'm a little afraid to say the majority, but that's my suspicion, is that the majority of the discussion of selling chametz was talking about scotch or whiskey. And this is the kind of chametz which people were doing business in, and it was this kind of chametz that people were very strongly hesitate just to throw overboard. And a lot of the literature during the Middle Ages, in terms of selling chametz, that was the problem. It wasn't just the problem of that, you know, you had an extra box of spaghetti in your cabinet. It was something which was worth far more in terms of the expense involved, and therefore the preparedness of somebody to get rid of it really would have been limited. Over here, in this case, again, I don't want to get too far into what the particular case was. Maybe they were traveling, got stuck, and he throws his food overboard. He'll have no food afterwards. So again, I don't know exactly what the case is, but either way, the Tosefta tells us two things which it does not see as a contradiction. One is that if you have chametz and Pesach is going to start, what do? You sell it or you give it away. And what's the other part it says to us, or the continuation of that is, and you could take it back after Pesach, but when you gave it, it needs to be a complete giving. Now you can say to me that that doesn't make sense. If it's one way or the other, you can't have this both ways. Either it was a complete giving, or you're going to get it back afterwards. It says no. You are allowed to have a deal that he will give it to you afterwards, but it is completely his during this time. It's not yours at all. Yeah, and you may set up with him certain financial parameters that, you know, for every bite he takes, how much he'll owe you, which is the way that sales generally work. But over here, this Tosefta is not playing a game. Again, I want you to appreciate it. This source is not playing a game. What is it saying? It's saying is that if you're going to do this, and then what do? Then you make sure that it is a complete matana. You're giving it to him. You completely don't want it. In your heart, in your soul, you do not want to own this, and therefore it belongs to him. No? We're happy, we're not happy? It still sounds like a game to you. Okay. In order to help you with the game, we're going to have to understand how it works, because we still don't know that. Another thing that you can claim to me based on this source, that this source is b'di'evid, not l'chadchila. What do you mean by b'di'evid, not l'chadchila? Here's talking about a case that you're stuck. You're stuck. So it doesn't say, again, you can make this argument with me. You can say that you're stuck, that in a case that you're stuck and you're in a boat, and that's why he gave us such an extreme case. Why not just say that if a Jew happens to have chametz in his house the day before Pesach, so go to the guy next door and sell it to him. It doesn't say that. It is talking about extreme case, although you can counter and say that sometimes extreme cases help us clarify law. And once the law is established, then it really doesn't make a difference afterwards. So over here, just again, in theory of learning this Tosefta, we can go two different ways. One is it's a b'di'evit situation, but it is a bona fide solution. The other possibility is that no, that was the case that happened, and because of that case, the rabbis gave their ruling, and it's perfectly fine. We will find, as we continue today, that there are fundamentally two approaches to how the sale of chametz works. It will be my contention that both of them will satisfy, by the time we're finished today, will satisfy that it's not a legal fiction, that both of them work, but they're very, very different approaches. And not only the different approaches, you may, as of right now, have an attitude that certain rabbis are more lenient and certain or more stringent. And what we sometimes don't appreciate is that it often happens that with every stringency, there's also a leniency which is involved. With every leniency, there may also be a stringency involved. So what we're going to also find that the two approaches that I'm going to bring up, in different cases, one will be strict and one will be lenient. But let's now go back and understand how this works. The first thing is, it's a yearly situation that we have chametz before Pesach. Matter of fact, it's a very nice thing to have chametz before Pesach. It's perfectly fine. It's wonderful. Not only that, after Pesach, you need to have chametz, at least during the time of the Beit HaMikdash. By the time you get to Chag Shavuot, where you have part of the offerings there was bread, you needed bread. Bread is fine. Chametz is fine. What are you supposed to do with your chametz with Pesach coming up? And what does the Torah want us to do? So, source number three is a pasuk in the Torah. Now, aside from this, there are a whole bunch of other verses that we have in terms of not owning, not seeing, by Yerah, by Yematzeh. I'm not reading all the verses right now. Let's read source number three. Shivat yamim matzot tochelu. For 7 days, you are to eat matzah. Ach, biyom hashrishon, but on the first day, tashbitu so'or mibateichem. No, I'm not going to translate tashbitu, and that's why you don't have any English for tashbitu. That part of the problem would be, what does the word tashbitu mean in this context? But on the first day, now the first day could also be a little bit confusing. On a Torah level, I'm not talking about the Mishnah, I'm not talking about the Gemara, I'm not talking about the way that we speak. On a Torah level, there are two different holidays. One holiday is Chag HaMatzot, and the other is Chag HaPesach. Chag HaPesach begins on the 14th from the time you can bring the Korban Pesach, which is the 14th in the afternoon. It lasts either until midnight or until the following morning. That's Chag HaPesach. Chag HaMatzot begins at sundown of the 15th and goes on for 7 days. Over here, when it says 7 days eat matzah, that first day, or that first, certainly that first evening, you have both days together. It is both Pesach and Chag HaMatzot, which means Chag HaPesach is the time you bring and eat the Korban Pesach. Once that's over, you have a 7-day holiday called Chag HaMatzot. So the first day, which is before the 7 days, you must, what does it say? Tashbitu so'or mibateichem. So what does that mean, tashbitu? And if you're not sure yet, then it goes to terrible things. Ki kola ochel chametz v'nichvata nefesh ahim yisrael miyom rishon ad yom ha-shvi. That you can't eat it, and so on. Now, what does the word tashbitu mean? So let's make believe that we have no idea, and look at the root of the word. Right. So therefore, if you would try to make this sentence in English, what would you say? Give the chametz a rest. V'yomar rishon tashbitu so'or mibateichem.
But also, we're not allowed to eat chametz for 7 days, but it's only mitzvah to eat matzah the first day. Like, there's no mitzvah to eat matzah the last 6 days.
And despite that, it does say here, eat matzah for 7 days. So there's a difference between a kiyum mitzvah and a chiyuv mitzvah. You're obligated to eat matzah on the first, be'erev tochlu matzot, you're obligated to eat on the first day, but you are mekayim a mitzvah, you fulfill a mitzvah by eating matzah all 7 days. If you don't want to eat matzah, you don't have to eat matzah. If you have a problem with matzah, then you should eat it with schmaltz. If you want, I'll give you a recipe. Do I make schmaltz? Okay.
With the
Greek. I do. She won't make it. You know what? I was once in a bookstore, and I see this book, and I like to look at cookbooks. Believe it or not, I like to cook. Is this true? It's true. So I like to buy cookbooks. So I pick up a cookbook, and I'm saying, I will never buy a book like this. It says, Cooking Kosher the Natural Way. I'm saying, there's no way I would want this in my house. Right? And then I open up, I'm read one page, two pages, and then look in the introduction. It says, you know, if you're scared of changing your kitchen, and then there's this thing that says that, what about schmaltz? So I said, okay, they're going to now say, and it goes on to say that schmaltz is actually healthier than lots of other things, and it gives a recipe for it. So I bought the book.
The difference between natural and healthy, schmaltz is natural.
Yes. So is cyanide, right? No, but it claimed that at least chicken fat was not. compared to trans fats, there's nothing to talk about. Compared to other things, nothing to talk about. It will be fatty, but it's not necessarily unhealthy. And it also depends how much you eat, but it goes wonderful with the matzah. Anyway, let's.
And it makes it
flavorful
all day.
No. Anyway, I recommend to you this cookbook called Cooking Kosher the Natural Way. Anyway, what does this word tashbitu means? It means give it a rest. So the Targum Onkelos over here writes, in source 4, Shivat Yuman Petirin Tichulun. So now you see that the word Petirin, you realize that Petirin, Pita, is close to matzah. Which, by the way, it's very, very likely that matzah in those days was similar to Pita or Eish Tanor. And I checked up and I found a Yemenite bakery that does make Pita. You buy them every year?
Yes.
So before Pesach.
Yes, and then afterwards we put laces on them and we wear them around.
Yeah, they're really that bad? Are they good fresh or they're not
no,
even good fresh?
Terrible. However, it doesn't matter. No, we always buy them from the Seder. There's too many people.
Fine. But they don't taste good.
Yeah.
Then we won't buy them. Okay, we'll still investigate that, which means you have to realize the Korban Pesach, which had meat and had, it was a shawarma,
mm-hmm.
That's what it was. They were eating a shawarma. Anyway, no, but they eat it wrapped. It says matzah rum dechulu. You think about Hillel, it says they eat it together. How exactly do you make a sandwich with matzah? That doesn't work very well. But if it's like a pita, you can wrap it around. They were eating an eish tanor. Anyway. Shivat yamim pitirin tichlun baram biyoma kadma'a, but on the first day, however, biyoma kadma'a, on the first day, tivatlun chamira mibotechen. So over here, he switched the word tashbitu for the word tivatlun. And you look at the root of the word tivatlun, what word do you see there? You see batel, bitul, which means nullify. So the Targum understands the way that you get rid of your chametz is by nullifying it, by being mevatel. Rashi writes, and this is Rashi on the Gemara, in source number 6, bitul be'alma. The topic over here, discussion is the action of bedikat chametz, is it the fulfillment of a Torah law or a rabbinic law? Why do we do bedikat chametz? Why do we search for chametz? So the Gemara over here in source 5 says, "Mi amrin and atu bedikat chametz deraita." Do we really say that bedikat chametz is a Torah law? Derabbanan hi, it's a rabbinic law. Midimaraita, that from the Torah bito ba'al masagi, that from the Torah perspective, it would be enough if all that you did was bitul, which means, look, at the end we do bedikah and we clean and we do bedikah and we do bitul and we do everything. But Rashi is claiming the Gemara is claiming over here, that if you only did bitul, if you nullified all your chametz, then that was good enough. There's a downside to nullifying your chametz and not doing anything else. And what's that? Your house is not kosher l'Pesach. That's the downside of doing this. Theoretically, if somebody were just, you know, going away before Pesach, all they have to do is do bitul. There is a rabbinic law that you have to do bedikah as well. That rabbinic law applies to any home that you own that you're in within 30 days of Pesach. That little place that you have in Colorado, if you haven't been there like in 6 weeks, then before Pesach, all you have to do is do the selo, do bitul, and you don't have to do anything else. The problem with bitul is then can you just go and take it afterwards or not? If you did bitul, it should be a real bitul. But selling it, which is what we're going to come back to, that would be fine. On a rabbinic level, I'll say it again, any home that you own that you've been in 30 days before Pesach, there is an obligation to do bedikah in that place within the 30 days.
When you say do bedikah, can't you just leave them in the cupboard where they are and say, oh, I've looked them up, there they are?
Probably.
You have to move it all around.
I didn't say you have to move it all around. But you do have an obligation, a rabbinic obligation of bedikah, certainly any place that you're going to be in on Pesach, because even if you said, I don't want this, and you wake up in the morning and the cake is still sitting there, so then you may come to eat it, which means that there's two separate problems. One problem is owning chametz, the other problem is eating chametz. And you see, even in this verse, there was this combination about owning and eating. So therefore, to solve the problem of owning is not necessarily the same as solving the problem of eating. If you want to solve the problem of eating, then you have to make sure that your kitchen is actually kosher to Pesach. You want to solve the problem of owning it, that could be much easier to accomplish.
In addition to your question, a person who's going away for the whole thing,
yeah.
seals up his cupboard, sells it, and does not move it. Does
So what I do when I sell chametz for people is I have two different dates to sell it. I can sell it on the 13th and I can sell it on the 14th. So what on the evening of the 14th, which is the 13th at night, is when we do bedikat chametz. So if anybody's going away the whole time, I'll sell it. The sale will be take place before the time of bedikat chametz. So when it comes time of bedikat chametz, you don't own it anymore. Mm-hmm. So therefore, once it's owned by the non-Jew, so it's not yours, so then you don't have to do bedikat. I mean, that's a technicality, but I will. Whenever people tell me they're going away, that's what I would suggest that they do. Because then, even though you did have an obligation, it's not yours anymore. So it's not yours, then it's fine. So let's get back to, now the Gemara said that on a Torah level, if you just did bitul, it's enough. Now how does the Gemara know this? Rashi writes in source 6, bitul ba'alma, it's enough to do bitul, dichtiv, for it says, tashbitu v'lo kativ tivaru. Because the Torah said, tashbitu. And what does Rashi understand? V'hashbata delev hi hashbata. And therefore, hashbata in your heart is considered hashbata, is considered a nullification. So let's try to say this in English now. What is Rashi teaching us? He's telling us, and we realize now, Rashi is in line with the Targum, that what does it say on the first day, give the chametz a rest, which means the day before Pesach, give chametz a rest. What does it mean to give chametz a rest according to Rashi? And that's how he understands the Gemara. What does it mean? That you nullified it in your heart. That means psychologically and emotionally, you have separated from your chametz. You and your chametz are no longer. Okay? Now, why exactly does that work and how exactly does that work is still not completely clear to us.
But he says you nullify it for a week or you nullify it?
You nullify it completely. You nullify it forever.
And you can't use it after.
And then you can't use it after. We're going to see now why, still, we're going to get to the point why a sale of chametz may be better than, or how it works. We're still not there yet. Let's go back now to source number two. Amar Rav Yehuda Amar Rav. Rav Yehuda said in the name of Rav, Habodek Tzorech Sheyivatel. Whoever searched for the chametz, searching means cleaning and searching. Searching, I want you to appreciate something. Even though that When we say bedikat chametz, so then you take out the candle and you can use a flashlight. It's probably better to use a flashlight because people do not use candles. We're not adept with candles today. People are far more adept with flashlights. Flashlights, with a candle, you'll be afraid to go into the corners. You'll be afraid, for good reason, to look behind the curtains. You'll be afraid to use it. So therefore, it's not very effective. It's not just the night where you have the flashlight or candle in your hand and the feather in your other hand, that's bedikat chametz. Any cleaning that you've done leading up to Pesach, certainly within a month of Pesach, is considered to be part of bedikat chametz. That is bedikat as well. I'm not getting into the question right now, so should you do bedikat again as well? No, not that's a separate point. But you shouldn't think that if you took your kitchen apart and you took all the drawers and you emptied them and you switched them and whatever, that wasn't bedikat chametz. Every single action involved in that is part of the mitzvah of bedikat chametz. So then you'll ask me about the bracha. The bracha is only said on that particular night. So therefore, if you are going away with Pesach and it's within 30 days and you're not selling the whole apartment, then you would do bedikat chametz the night before you leave, but without a bracha. The only time you say a bracha, bedikat chametz, is on that particular night, and over here, it's on a rabbinic level. So over here, the Gemara says, so we now appreciate that bedikat chametz is a rabbinic fulfillment of a way of getting rid of your chametz. Amar Rav Yehuda, Amar Rav, habodek tzorech sheyivatel. But whoever did bedikah still needs to nullify, still needs to do bitul chametz. That after you finish searching, you should still say, now, if I missed anything, anything that I own is hereby ownerless and void. What?
Very good psychologically.
It's very good psychologically. And the Mishnah Berurah stresses that you shouldn't think that this is some kind of magical thing that you're saying or it's some kind of good luck charm. You have to understand what you're saying. And if you don't understand the Aramaic, then you say it in English. And what you're saying is, any chametz that I own is hereby null and void and ownerless. Now, the question is still, what does that accomplish? My taima, what's the reason? Inei mishum pirurin, if what you're afraid of, what are pirurin?
Crumbs.
Ha lo chashivi. Now, this goes against every ganenet. Because all the kids come home always, what are you looking for? We're looking for crumbs. So what did the Gemara just now tell you? Crumbs are not chametz. Should I say this again? Crumbs are not chametz. We're not looking for crumbs. Why not? Because they're not important. Lo chashivi. You know, when we say bito, what do we say? That our chametz should be like the crumbs on the floor. That's what we're saying. Our chametz is nullified like the dust on the earth. So therefore, our chametz, which is already on the floor like dust on the earth, that's not a problem. So the Gemara says, no, it's not food. The Gemara says, crumbs are not food, and therefore when you clean for... Good. They'll eat other things as well. Right? Yeah, it's not food. Can't prove from grandchildren what is food.
Right. We had a dog who would eat anything.
Right. We had a dog.
A normal dog. No. But this is an important thing over here. Crumbs are not considered to be chametz as far as your own. You talk about psychological health. According to halacha, you do not have to search for crumbs, which means that if you swept up your floor, that's it. Whatever's left afterwards. Okay, let's appreciate something else. Let's just say that you are a little crazy, which is fine. And I don't want to make fun of you. It's okay. Let's just say that you are neurotic about chametz, and therefore you take a blowtorch to your floor, you take a blowtorch to everything, right? There's nothing left. You've seen this. You take each balata and you put it in the mikveh and you take it back and you put it, and after you pour boiling water and acid and whatever you want, okay? Pesach begins. Somebody walks in from outside and they wore shoes. So what do you think is on your floor now? Which means, unless you somehow sanitized the entire world, it's not going to help. Which I'll go back to my point now, that the dirt on your floor that used to be food is called crumbs, and this is not a problem on Pesach. And I don't want to hear anything else from you, and you can do whatever you want, and if you feel that you want to get rid of it, fine. It's very good. I'm happy. Let's continue. Correct. No, not the... Okay, I'm sorry. Bread... Okay, when I said crumbs, I meant on the floor. I didn't mean the stuff you're going to put on your schnitzel afterwards. Okay? No, correct. But by the way, that's an important point. Little crumbs around are not about... The problem is if it's together and there's a kazayit of it, which means if you have lots of crumbs together, which here, the funny thing is, people will clean, and let's say they'll take their vacuum cleaner and find every single crumb and collect it together. Where would they collect it? In their vacuum cleaner. And now they forget to empty their vacuum cleaner bag. So now they have succeeded by cleaning for Pesach. They have collected a kazayit of crumbs in one place, and now they are guilty of having chametz. Had they not collected it... Correct, and that's why...
And that's why
bitul is good after the fact, but the Gemara is saying over here, but let's be honest, crumbs are crumbs, and crumbs is not a problem. So, when the Gemara said, whoever does have to do bitul, why do you have to do bitul? What did it say? Well, it's certainly not for crumbs. Why not? Because, I want you all to say this now, because crumbs are not?
Chametz.
Excellent, very well done. Because crumbs are not chametz. Okay. Well done. I know you don't believe me.
So, what about those people who won't take water from the canary? Mm-hmm. Because it may have some points. Somebody might have thrown a bread into the ducks.
It was bottle before Pesach. You don't have to worry about that. Now, the Gemara goes on. I'm going to skip a line over here. We'll skip a line. Amar Rava. Gzeira Shema Yimtza Gluska Yafa Vidaitul Ila. That what's the problem? That he may find within his house a nice piece of cake and then he's going to want to eat it. Now the problem is you don't own it. But you don't own it. Why? One second. Right. So then, one second. Let me go back. Over here, the problem is that you may find it and you're going to end up eating it. So the Gemara says, so then it's not going to help any, you know, very much in order to go ahead and do bitul. Now, bitul is not going to help in such a case because it's not going to be yours and you end up eating it. Unless the idea of the Gemara is that it's not yours, but the second you see it, now you want it. So let's say it was hefker, it was ownless, but now it's yours. Either way, let's continue a little bit because that's not the main point. We'll skip a little bit. Still, it's in your possession. You still have to do a bit. The Amar Rabbi Lezer, Rabbi Lezer said, "Shnei dvarim einon berushuto shel adam." There are two things that a person does not really own. Va'asa'an hakatuv ki'ilu berushuto, and the Torah assigned it to you and made it as if you own it, which means there's two things in this world you really don't own. You can think you own it, you don't own it. But the Torah gives it to you. Why does it give it to you? Just to be guilty. That doesn't sound very nice. What are the two things? V'eluhein, bor b'rishut harabim, v'chametz mishesh sha'ot umala. That both a bor b'rishut harabim and chametz, from the time that it's not allowed, from the sixth hour onwards, they're not yours. Now, what does it mean it's not yours? Let's go to the chametz example for a second. Let's say that you like a seven-layer cake, not kosher l'Pesach. Okay, that's not going to work for you. Remember the bakeries in Brooklyn that had these chocolate bells? You don't remember the chocolate bells? Little cake on the bottom, then a lot of white cream, and then chocolate cream on top. You remember that? Now, if I would have said to you, "Hareyat mukudeshetli," with a chocolate bell, would you have agreed? Not a question, right? Didn't need a ring. Now let's just say a man goes to a woman and says, "Hareyat mukudeshetli," with this cake, and she says, "Fine, it's worth more than a pruta," right? That is worth more than a pruta, and she agrees. Are they married? Yes, they're married. You know, it doesn't have to be a ring. You can give a piece of cake. You give a whole cake. Carvel ice cream cake. Does that work for you better? Okay. You're married. What?
Pistachio.
Okay. Everyone has their price. We can find what it is. Now, what if a man said to a woman, "Hareyat mukudeshet li," with this cake, but it's on Pesach? Are they considered married? So the answer is no. Why? Because it's not his. It's not his cake. Why isn't his cake? Because it's asr bahana. It's asr bahana means you're not allowed to derive any pleasure from it. So if you can't derive pleasure from it, it's not yours. If it's not yours, I can't perform a wedding with it. Now, let's go back a second. If it's not mine, why should I be guilty for owning it? It's not mine. So what did this Gemara say? That there's two things in this world which are not yours, but the Torah only gives it to you in order that you should be guilty for owning it. But it's not really yours. The other thing, by the way, was a bor b'rishut harabim making a hole, a pit, in a public thoroughfare. It's not yours. You don't own that public thoroughfare. You don't own it. But the Torah gives it to you because it gives you responsibility for it. That means anybody who now gets hurt in that, you're going to have the responsibility for that pit. Over here, the Gemara says that you don't own chametz. Again, how do I know you don't own chametz? I can't do anything with the chametz. I can't use it for barter. I can't use it. It's not mine. But the Torah gives it to you in order to own it. Now, if it gives it to me in order to own it, how do I get rid of it then? All I need to do is to psychologically, emotionally say, I don't want it. Which means this is how the bitul works. The bitul works is because the chametz isn't mine. Why isn't it mine? Because the Torah said you're not allowed to eat it, you're not allowed to possess it, you're not allowed to have it. By yira, by yamatzah, you can't own chametz. It's not yours. Now, if it's not mine, why am I guilty for owning it? Because I didn't take action to get rid of it. So when I put all of this together, what do I need to do to get rid of the chametz? I need to wish it away. Give it a rest. It's not mine. I don't want it. I have no desire for it. Which means this thing, which is called bittul, is actually very powerful. It works by itself. You don't need anything else. The truth is you didn't need to do bedika. Oh, the rabbi said, do bedika, search and clean your house as well. Why? Because the odds are you're going to be in your house for Pesach. If you're in your house for Pesach, you may end up eating it, may end up finding real chametz there. But in order to rid yourself from owning chametz, all that you really need to do is to say with sincerity, I don't want this. I don't want this chametz. Why? Because it's not yours. God is giving it back to you. What are you saying back to God? Thank you, but no thank you. I don't want it. It's yours. Keep it. Yeah. And by the way, that's why there's also no problem with Baal Tashchit for burning it and getting rid of it. It's not yours. You're showing you don't want this. Yeah.
What about what you learned in second grade? You're not allowed to see chametz. You're not allowed to flavor. You're not allowed to.
They were kidding. You're allowed to see chametz.
If you find chametz in your house that you didn't know was there, you're supposed to throw it away. You
should burn it.
Should burn it on
Christmas? Yeah. Either on Chol HaMoed or not on the holidays.
Hold on.
Cover it. You cover it and then you burn it on Chol HaMoed. Okay? Okay. Depends. It depends how your sale went, what you had in mind. The problem with selling is selling something you don't know about.
I have a friend who left.
I have a friend, okay. Okay, okay, okay. Okay. Right, so they should have burnt it then.
So I think they just threw something on it and it stayed there.
No, this was the burning of Clamoid. So you could tell back and say they failed.
Yeah.
Okay, that's fine. you're supposed to burn it at that point. So now let's get back to our problem of selling chametz. Selling chametz, how does it work? So the Chatam Sofer, which we're going to skip a lot to get to him here, which is all the way in source 15. In the beginning over here, this tshuva, the part on top that he says, there are people who question the validity of selling chametz. Certainly if the non-Jew knew he was going to sell it back afterwards, and maybe the non-Jew thinks it's a game. That's a very important element. The non-Jew thinks it's a game. So maybe there's a problem over here. So he plays a little bit with an idea of how a kinyan works, how acquisition works on a Torah law, which means if the non-Jew, if we said, okay, my community has a total of $500,000 worth of chametz, I want you to give me a check for $500 right now, and after Pesach, you decide to keep the whole thing, you'll give me the rest of the money, which means money took place. By the way, that's called a kinyan. So he says, now what if the non-Jew thinks it's a joke and every single year at the end you give him the check back and nothing ever happens, so he doesn't think it's real. So the first part of the tshuva, the Chatam Sofer says, it doesn't make a difference what he thinks. That's a real kinyan. That it was an acquisition as far as Torah law goes. So that was the first part. I mean, we want to read a little bit. For itim ha-shekotiv od sham la-arer ha-mechiret chametz shalonu kevin she'ein da'ato shel akum l'knot, the non-Jew doesn't really want to buy it. Ki ha-akum sofer she'yudi eino osa ela dat mitzvot. Because he thinks the Jew's only doing this because it's a mitzvah and doesn't really think that it's legitimate. As I said, he goes into a little bit of laws about how kinyanim work. In the end of that paragraph, he writes, in ke mechiret she'anu mochir na-chametz be-kinyan d'yoraita afilo ein da'ato shel goy l'knot koneh. That since we follow the prescription of how you do a proper acquisition in Torah law, it doesn't make a difference what he thinks. A kinyan did take place. That's the first point. But then he continues, and he gives another possible answer. And then after all that, he writes, Amnam lefi ani idate, which is the next paragraph, and that's the Lamed Pei Ayin Dalet. Amnan, however, lefi ani idate, according to my humble opinion, hakushe meikar leita, there is no question to begin with, mitre tame, for a couple different reasons, chadama li imdat hagoy leknot olo, anan loy balaknot legoy, ela lotzim rishut she Yisrael. He says, the reality is, I don't care if the guy bought it, because that's not the objective. What's the objective? That it doesn't make a difference if it enters into the non-Jew's possession. What's the important thing? That it leaves the Jew's possession. Now that itself was a very interesting comment. So he says no. He says not necessarily. But then he continues and he says, okay, I'll explain the rest of what he says. He essentially sees the sale of chametz working the same way as bittul working. That the main thing is to say, I don't want it. And therefore, if a Jew can say, I don't want it by saying, it's here by bittul, or he can say, I don't want it by saying, I'm selling it. But according to the Chatam Sofer, the core of the sale of chametz is not the fact that the other guy bought it or wanted to buy it or so on. It is the expression of the Jew saying, I don't want this chametz. And therefore, putting it within a sale is him expressing that it's tashbitu, saying, I don't want it. That's a way of fulfilling our expression of not wanting to own chametz, which means he doesn't see the sale of chametz fundamentally within other areas of sales. His whole first attempt to answer the question, he did take it within the rules of sales. He goes in terms of sales, technically the sale took place, but he says, I don't think there's a question over here, because as far as I understand, chametz, we don't own the chametz. Let's go back to the initial one. We don't own chametz. Why do we own chametz? Because the Torah says, no, it's yours. Now, what if you create a sale to show that you don't want it? So he's saying, that is enough. There's a second approach, which is found in the writings of Moshe Feinstein, which is both in source 13 and 14, where he deals with situations of what happened by stores that sell their chametz, but they're not very sincere about it. Look at source 13. He writes this to this is 1957. He's Hey Er in 1957. So this is what Rav Moshe did on Yom HaTzmaut that year. To summon Rav Nachman Yosef Goldstein, B'davar ha-chenvonim shemochrim chamtzam al yedei harav kinahug, the stores that sell the source 13 sell their chametz as people generally do. V'hu chashud lavor the schor b'chametz b'pesach, and but this guy is going to keep really the store open. He'll keep on selling his chametz on Pesach, which is a problem that happens lots of places every year. Source 14, Leva'er ha-to'elot de-mechira chametz shel chanvanim chashudim. Erev Rosh Chodesh Iyar, Tovshin Kaf, 1960, which he writes to Yedidi Harav Hagon, Rav David Rachman, who was Emmanuel Rachman's father, who was a significant rabbi. And both of them, they both are dealing with the same question. And Rav Moshe gives a very, very simple and straightforward answer. And Rav Moshe's approach is that the sale of chametz needs to be absolutely a legally binding sale. The contract needs to be very carefully set up. The contract needs to fit within the laws of the land of the particular place that it was written in. A lawyer needs to look at the contract. A rabbi needs to look at the contract. It would stand up in court. If this contract stands up in court, it is a bona fide 100% sale. Now let's go back to the problem over here. The case which he's dealing with is the case of the store that sells the chametz before Pesach. During Pesach, it also sells the chametz. And which chametz does it sell? The chametz that it was already sold. And then you come in after Pesach and you want to buy chametz there. And somebody tells you, you can't buy chametz there. Why not? Because that store was open on Pesach, and they sold chametz on Pesach. So what would Rav Moshe say in such a situation? Well, you can read through both of these tshuvot, and you know what he says? He says he says it's fine, and you can buy there after Pesach. Why? Because he says that sale was a 100% legal sale. The fact that this guy sold his chametz on Pesach, you know what he was doing? He was stealing. So everything that he sold over Pesach, he was stealing from the non-Jew, and that's between him and the non-Jew. Everything that was not sold, anything that you go in after Pesach to take, so you know what he says about that? He says, that was sold on Pesach. How do I know it was sold? Because the sale was a legally binding sale. That's Rav Moshe's approach. Let's go back to the Chtam Sofer.
If it's according to the law of the land.
Yes.
And he was stealing.
Yes. It's criminal he certainly should be, and severely chastised, but the person who can press charges is the non-Jew who theoretically bought it. Now, whether he wants to press charges or not. I mean, if you have a partner, and you sell it, and you have a deal with the partner, that's between you and your partner. That's not between the government.
It's not criminal, is it? No, if you're stealing something, that's criminal.
But it's from your partner. Correct. But who is he stealing from? He's stealing from this non-Jew. If this non-Jew wants to come over to him now and say to him, you sold my chametz on Pesach, I want you to pay me for it. That's between the two of them. But Rav Moshe would insist that anything which was in the store, was anything which was not sold, you go in the day after Pesach, he would say, you are permitted to buy that chametz because it was sold with the other chametz. It was sold. But this all comes from Rav Moshe's starting point that he thinks the sale needs to be a 100% bona fide sale. Yeah.
Why can't they, when they do the contract, couldn't they make that part of the contract that he can sell?
Most rabbis would not help with a contract that would say whatever's left afterwards is okay, what you sell on pay. I mean, the rabbi helps
can't
him make
a contract. Like, can't the non-Jew contract out the Jew, okay, you sell my chametz next week?
That's not so simple either for him to be able to do that. That's not a simple thing. Theoretically, maybe you could create such a thing. But either way, what I want you to see is what Rav Moshe said, that such a sale is, it's real. The sale of chametz is real. And because it's real, even in this extreme case, it worked. Now, what would the Chatam Sofer say in this case? The Chatam Sofer would say that this person, did he want to rid himself of his chametz? Did he fulfill this tashbitu? Did he give his chametz a rest? Absolutely not. So the Chatam Sofer in such a case could end up coming and say, well, sorry, such a person did not really sell his chametz because he never had that emotional separation from his chametz because he, as far as he was concerned, the whole thing was a joke. So therefore, in this case, Rav Moshe, who would say you need a real sale, would end up having a lenient perspective, while the Chatam Sofer says, no, you have to rid yourself from it, would end up being stringent. Now, let me give you a backwards example. A number of years ago, and this was a real case, there was this Arab who was who sold the chametz every year. They would sell it to him, and he was interviewed on the radio, and he was asked, well, why do you agree to do this every year? Why do you want to help the Jews? He said, listen, I feel very close to Jews. Matter of fact, my mother was Jewish. Now, this is a true story. This is a true story. Now, this is a true story. Now, you then have mass hysteria, because what happened to all the chametz that were sold to this fellow over the years, and you know, and so on. And let's go back. According to Rav Moshe Feinstein, which is a bona fide sale, this chametz was owned by a Jew over Pesach. You have a problem. After Passover, it was owned by a Jew during Passover. I'll solve that problem for you in a second, but right now, as a starting point, you have a problem. According to the Chatam Sofer, were you guilty for owning your chametz on Pesach? No. Why? Because you rid yourself. You rid yourself of this chametz. Now there is something which a number of Achronim bring up. I have a book over here which I'm afraid to open with all the chametz that was placed on my table. It's called Piskei Tshuvot. It's very interesting. This is volume 5. It is a commentary on the Mishnah Berurah, bringing the Mishnah Berurah up to date. Mishnah Berurah was finished around 1920, 1930. Chofetz Chaim died in 1933. Maybe I think 1918 he wrote the last volume. And I may be making that up, but I think that's right. But 100 years have gone by, 90 years have gone by. And what he does is he brings up all the new cases, like your Dud Shemesh and things. It brings up all the new cases going on each part of the Mishnah Berurah and the Shulchan Aruch and the Shailot to Tshuvot and so on. So he does have a question over here. What happens? His name is Rabinowitz, and he's a Simcha Ben Sion something Rabinowitz. And he comes from a Hasidic family, which gives it a certain bent to certain things that he says. But he does bring up this case of chametz being sold. Let's say you have a big company, or you know, I don't know if Walbaum's really is, does it exist anymore? I don't know.
Probably not. Even if this exists, it's probably owned by
stockholders. Right. So you have a lot of these big chains that may be owned by a Jew, but it could be that the Jew is a completely assimilated Jew, but he owns the chain of food stores. So therefore, theoretically, So theoretically, it's a big problem. So theoretically, you may not be able to go into that store until all the things are off the shelf. And you will find rabbis who will tell you this, and you'll find little Pesach books that these things are written saying. Okay, so he brings down a number of different tshuvot that write as follows: that chametz. The truth is that maybe we should talk about this next week, but I'll say it quickly now. Chametz after Pesach, that you're not allowed to derive benefit from chametz after Pesach. Is that a Torah law or a rabbinic law? That's a rabbinic law. And it's what it's called is a knas. It's a punishment, which means somebody who went and kept chametz on Pesach, we punish them and saying, you can't use your chametz now after Pesach. It's a knas. So he says, what if there's a Jew who doesn't care about the rabbi saying there's a knas or not a knas? They're just so far away from it. So he says a knas only works. You can only give somebody a punishment if they care. If they're so far from it, they don't care, then there's no knas at all. So he wants to say in such a case, who are you giving the knas to by telling him that you can't go shopping in the store? You're giving it to the religious Jew who wants. So again, there are a number of poskim who say in such a situation, you can go to that store after Pesach. Now, if you're going to realize this, what happens to this Muslim who's Jewish, who bought the chametz from the Jews, and then after Pesach we find out that he was really Jewish. So we're going to say, now all that chametz, the Jews themselves sold their chametz, they got rid of it, they were sincere. And by the way, for this reason, when you sell the chametz, you should be sincere about it, like Chaim Sofer says, and say, I want to rid myself of my chametz, and that's why I'm doing this. Afterwards you find out that something went wrong along the way, the guy was Jewish, or all kinds of things go wrong. There is what to rely on to then say that, okay, so there should be a knas here. Who gets the knas? You're going to tell the Muslim he gets a knas. He's going to care he gets a knas. He's going to care that you're telling him that he can't use his chametz after Pesach. He doesn't care. He doesn't even consider himself Jewish. So therefore, there are poskim who would rely on this in a case like that. And that's really how they ended up creeping out of it, by saying, you can't give a knas to him because he doesn't care. You're going to punish the Jews who did the right thing, and they sold their chametz. So the end of the day, it was okay. Now, I had a real tragedy in my community. A couple of years ago, there was this fellow who bought a bottle of scotch. And, well, it went like this. One person in the community was flying Motzai Chag. And somebody else who had either finished or drank or poured out, most likely drank, the rest of his scotch Erev Pesach, said, can you buy me a bottle in duty-free? So he says, sure. So he buys a bottle in duty-free, and even two bottles, and he gives it to him like a week later. In the meantime, somebody tells him, you couldn't buy in duty-free. They stay open. They sell the chum. So, right. So he calls me up and he asks me what to do. So I said, well, we have to check a couple of things. First, we have to check who really owns the store. Secondly, we have to check if they sell their chametz. So after checking a little bit, we find out that they did sell their chametz. Nonetheless, the Rabbanut puts a big thing in the ads in religious newspapers saying that they didn't sell their chametz and they were open over Pesach and therefore no one can use any of it. So now we had contradictory information. So it turns out that this is what happened. That the Lubavitch guys...
In this case,
this is what happened. I can't tell you, well, I'll tell you what to do. This is what happened. The Lubavitch fellows from the airport, they went to all the stores and they sold everybody's chametz. By the way, there are other sources, which I didn't include here, that you are allowed to sell people's chametz even if they don't know about it. Don't ask me about it. Because you can sell people's chametz for them. People who would have appreciated it. I have some non-religious neighbors who will come to me to sell their chametz sometimes before Pesach, sometimes on Pesach. So I already know I have a list of people that I sell for. I put them on the list as well. Because they'll always ask me, but the question is at which point they'll remember to ask me. So I always add them. No, they don't need it. They don't need it. They put away. So anyway, I told you this was a tragedy. So in this particular case, so what happened? That's right. No, well, I don't know. They took it difficult. Anyway, the Lubavitch guys, it turned out, sold everybody's chametz, even the ones in the stores that were going to stay open, because they figured it's better to do it. Which, by the way, takes us back to Rav Moshe's example, because the chametz was sold. The Rabbanut was very upset with this. Why was the Rabbanut upset? Because the store stayed open, and they want to use this as leverage. So they said, no, this isn't good, because no, we didn't sell the chametz wasn't sold. So the reality is that it was sold. It was sold through one Rabbanut. By the way, I also have a tshuva over here. You can sell your chametz to two different rabbis. And that's a deal also. Part of the reason for this is that in lots of communities where rabbis never got paid, they would slip the rabbis some money on Erev Pesach when they sell the chametz. But there is a question who's it's going to, but I'm saying there are tshuvot about that as well, which I think adds to people's attitudes, how serious can this be? Anyway, in this particular case, this fellow, as soon as he heard the Rabbanut said he couldn't use it, he poured out the scotch because he said, okay, that's it, you can't use it. And afterwards I told him that... But by the way, don't laugh at him. Women do this also all the time. They'll call me up, my stupid husband. That's the way the question begins. My stupid husband used my fleishik pot to cook this in, and then by the time I finish with the question, so what did you do? Well, I threw it away. So generally what will happen in such cases, the food was kosher, the pot wasn't. So it was probably a good shidduch. Yeah. Anyway. So that's the thing. It's a knas. It's a punishment. It's a knas. It's a rabbinic law, and the rabbinic law generally will go on the individual. This is not a simple question that you're raising. It's not a simple question. And as I said, there are some people say that a knas can only apply in certain cases. The Mishnah Berurah brings a case. What happens if you did bitul and you sold your chametz and then Something went wrong along the way. And then you find out afterwards. So he says, okay, you did all that you can do. So would Chazal really give you a knas? So he says, in such a case, you shouldn't eat it, but you can sell it. So even though you say, oh, no, it's a sore and you should burn it afterwards. Like, yeah, so you burn it when you didn't do what you should have done. So as I said, once you're dealing with afterwards and you realize it's a rabbinic level, so then you have to see where does it apply. So what I tried to show today, in duty-free specifically, what's best to do is right before the term, in the big stores, at least from last year, in the big stores they didn't sell the chametz properly, if they did it at all. There's a little store right before the terminal where they do sell their chametz. There's a religious guy who sits in that store.
Why not just buy it abroad?
You could do. You could.
Why in America? No, because it's like a 3-month thing, isn't it?
I don't know how long that really is, but I'm saying there is a little store which is closer to the terminal, like right before, like the end of D over there. There's a little store over there which is run by a religious fellow, and he does sell the chametz. Theoretically. Anyway, let's review what we did today. Even though there is cynicism regarding the sale of chametz, what I was trying to show you is that we need to understand how the sale of chametz works. If we understand that the problem with owning chametz is that fundamentally chametz is not yours, and the Torah gives it to you and says it is yours, and what you need to do is to say, I don't want it, so therefore the sale of chametz could, according to one approach, the Chatam Sofer, falls into that category. It's similar to bitul, and all that you need to do is to express that you don't want it. One way of expressing it is by doing bitul. The thing about bitul is you can't go and get it back afterwards. Over here, if we go back to our first source in the Tosefta, you can make a bona fide sale and say, I don't want it. Why don't you want it? Because you don't want to be guilty. How are you guilty if you own it? But if you give it to him 100%, no strings attached, it's yours. I don't want it. After Pesach, you want it. That's not a contradiction, because it's not yours, so you're going to say that you don't want it and give it to someone else. He's happy to take it. He's happy to buy it from you. He's happy to do a proper kinyan. So then, wonderful. According to Rav Moshe, and as I said, I'm just picking these names. We could have found lots of other people to take either side. According to Rav Moshe, that whoever does the sale needs to make sure that it really is a proper sale. Once it's a proper sale, so therefore, it's not yours. It's not a game. It's not yours. Yeah.
There are
some people who will say that the sale of chametz should only be done by not real chametz. There are some people who will say that the sale of chametz should only be done with not real chametz, only not Torah level chametz. And whether scotch is real chametz or not is also part of the problem. You don't see that in the initial source. You don't see that in Tosefta, and there are different customs. If your personal family custom is not to sell real chametz, don't sell real chametz. If your family custom is to sell real chametz, you can sell real chametz. People also have a custom not to sell something open. Now, that's also because the original thing about selling of chametz is that it should be real, it should be significant, and it should be something really of substance. And therefore, the custom became, if you had an open thing, either you finish it or you throw it away. Sometimes dealing with people, especially in difficult economic situations, dealing with students who, that's a significant amount of money. The issue is not whether it's opened or not opened. The issue is it really considered to be something significant or not? And if for you there's a significant financial loss, then you can even sell something which is open. But as I said, a lot of people have a custom not to, but an economic need will override that custom. As I can assure you, I can assure you that there are many people who will sell open bottles of scotch. I personally will sell open bottles of scotch. I have some bottles which are quite expensive, and I don't. Richie's not coming for Shabbos. I don't think we'll finish them before Pesach, so I will absolutely sell them, even though they're open. Yeah.
What about the problem of Ashkenazi Sephardi, the things you do sell, the things you don't sell, what home you're going to, what home they're coming to, and all the rest of it? Because some things are defined as chametz by Ashkenazi, but some are defined by Sephardi.
Very, very, very few things. Kitniot is something else. Yeah. Kitniot is not chametz. Kitniot you don't have to sell. Kitniot you can have on your plate, just don't eat it. Right? That's something else.
Doesn't do
anything to your plate. If you're in their house. If you're in their house, it could be on your plate. You're just not allowed to eat it.
There's an interesting story of a rebellion by the housewives before the Second World War. In Romania, the housewives learned that throw out their perfume. They put it in the same place that the whiskey.
They should have put it in the whiskey bottles. that also happened. The odds of anybody's perfume today being chametz is very, very small. Okay, we will continue.